Accession number 10165, reel number 26.
Martin McLean, reel 26. What happened next on the mole at Dunkirk?
Everyone was so shattered, seen this awful sight first thing in the morning, that they, half asleep or dazed, hurried off the mole as quickly as they could and disappeared into the sands, got scattered, just scattered complete into the sands of Dunkirk. And then some of us went back to see what we could do about getting these wounded poor people off. And from there on, a host of people came to help, dragging out the wounded, shifting out the dead, and laying them up to one side, but mainly trying to do something for wounded. And there must have been a field dressing station here at hand, because as we were involved in helping to get the wounded out, someone was carrying them off. So we cleared the way, in other words. We went back on the sands of Dunkirk and sat around wondering what to do, because they said they'd only try to get us off tomorrow morning. We had been informed that that was the final evacuation from our headquarters under Brigadier Lawson when we went for this meeting with him about leaving the bridge and leaving our last line of defence. Hans Corporal Fallon got busy with his normal pursuit, and that was shooting at German aircraft. He seemed to get a great kick out of it, but there was no result from his shooting. These planes flew too fast. I don't know. We weren't really keyed up for shooting at aircraft with rifles. We had practiced it in platoon groups or company groups, aiming in front of an aircraft and everybody firing together. But we all had our weapons, but I just ignored it. It was pointless, I thought. Bob Bullman and I went walking along the seafront to see, nothing else to do but put the time in now. Went walking along the towards the sea, and there was wreckage of the small rowing boats and things that had been wrecked, and wreckage all along the front, washing up with the waves. The evacuation had stopped from the source now. There's no small boats coming in to take troops off the sand. So it was peaceful, just like a normal holiday weekend, with the exception of floating just under the surface of the water and near the land was bodies of troops, all sorts of different states and conditions. They'd been killed or drowned or exploded, with shells and things like that. But it was rather gruesome. There was bodies just floating there, waiting just for the tide to go out and leave them stranded. We got away from there, and we wandered along, and I don't know if I told you about seeing all the artillery guns and everything that had been left standing. We went further along the beach, and there was a battery of 3.7 artillery guns, which were anti-aircraft guns, something we had never seen before, and all the barrels were pointing up into the air. And they were all peeled back. They'd exploded them. In other words, they blew the guns. And we had a good look at all this thing, and they could have done invaluable work, these people, if they'd only stayed at their positions. That is, providing they had the ammunition, of course. And we went around and found brand new Lewis guns, which were twin Lewis guns for ACAT defence, in these boxes, all covered in the mineral jelly red, which we cleaned up and had a look at, and then we flung the parts away so that nobody could use the guns away. Again, we knew Lewis guns, so we dismantled the working parts. If they found the parts of the gun, they couldn't use them, the working parts were gone. And we wandered around the beach all day, and we eventually found the lads again. We all got together and we just fell asleep waiting for the next evening.
What day was that? I don't know whether we...
That would be Monday morning. See, we had to get on the mole. We had to be in Dunkirk at 10 o'clock on Sunday night to be evacuated. On the Monday morning, we walked along the mole to get on when they come along and told us so many ships had been sunk and in this devastation of dead bodies. Now we're into Monday. And we fell asleep, obviously. We were very hungry. Not as hungry as some people. We had been fed on the bridge. We now had no food, but as you know, young men, they're ready for food at any time. We went hunting for food, but there was nothing doing. At this time, Dunkirk was the seafront where the houses were. They had like this sand, and then they had a roadway, and inside the roadway they had these houses. In other words, the road run along the seafront, nothing on the left hand side, going along towards it. Anyway, I couldn't say it was north or south, But on one side of the road, there's nothing at all, just seafront. On the other side, there's all the houses, the estaminets, the buildings and everything. Well, the Germans had found range among this and were dropping shells in there, or bombs. Could be mortar bombs, could be shells, I don't know what they were, but they're certainly causing some dust and rubbish to fly up. We were in the sand, and there was no shells landing there, it so happened. There was not so many people on the sand now. Well, let's see it this way. Compared to when I first saw it, was nearly empty. There were still some people on, but nearly empty.
Were there any signs of panic amongst the people?
No, I think we'd all resigned now that we're all going to be prisoners of war. The fact was that when they told us 9 out of 12 ships been sunk, I said there's no chance them sending ships for us now at this stage. We were all fully equipped, and as it became dusk, we all started forming up and making our way along the mole again with the hopes that we would be picked up. Somebody must have told them from the naval side that get along the mole ready for picking up. We were fully armed with all our equipment, Bren guns and an anti-tank rifle, which I refused to allow the men to dump. They all had their equipment on, and funny enough, we were the only ones dressed in this way. We were fully ready for anything at all, because I honestly thought, even at this stage, that we were going to be transported further south of France, where we could reorganise and fight again. Not for one moment did I think that we were being evacuated to England. A ship came along eventually, a destroyer, hurried in, tied up, pulled into the wharf, and there was an officer shouting through a megaphone from the bridge, "Jump on, jump on, get on, we've only a couple of minutes to stay here." He says, "Get on as fast as you can." So we had our rifles and everything with which we couldn't jump with. We handed them down to the sailors, they dumped them for us, and we jumped down as we were, no landing next. It wasn't too far to jump. We jumped down and they grabbed a hold of us, pushed us aside, and everybody's just jumping over the side in like an invasion onto a boat, like bandits, like pirates jumping onto a ship. We grabbed our stuff and we went to the stern end of the ship. And I think they called this ship Silvaris or something of that name. It is Ness, the name. I've got it written down somewhere, but I haven't looked up any notes for this. We got on this destroyer. And within a couple of minutes, he was casting off was away from the jetty, pulling out, and he backed out of this place where the little motorboat had come along the previous night and told us all about the sinking ships. There was a lot of wreckage around and damaged vehicles, damage of all description. And he avoided the wrecks and the damage, and he pulled out and set off for sea.
Were any left on the mole?
Well, there was more left on the mole, yes. But apparently we weren't interested in them. It was no matter. We were off. We were going somewhere. We could do our job again. It was a matter we were lucky. If they were unlucky, that was it. But whether any more ships come in or not, I don't know. But we set off to sea. And we were pursued by bombers, dive bombers, for a while. And one came hurtling down, and you could see the bombs dropping from it. And it straddled the stern end of the ship, the destroyer, and lifted the stern end of the destroyer up. They missed it, destroyer. But they went very close to it, and they lifted the stern end of the destroyer up and showered us with water, not that we minded. And the captain of the ship was zigzagging to avoid these bombs. Anyway, we got away, we fell asleep. And I woke up once, and there was a couple of very old sailors standing by a Bren gun. They were the Akak Defence, part of the, I should imagine, now, Akak Defence of the ship, added to by other weapons. Two old reserve sailors, you could see them, one was very grey-haired, no hat on. And I got on talking to them. And I said, "Would you like a drink of rum?" Well, I had in my water bottle, a bottle full of this army rum that I had explained in a previous instance that we got from one of the supply depots. And I give these sailors a drink, and they said, "Gee, that's great stuff. That's stronger than our rum." Well, I don't know where that was or not, but we get ladled out one tablespoonful of this rum. That was a man's ration. And they enjoyed it. And that was it. We in the early hours of the morning, we start creeping into a shore. You could see the shore where the men were waking up now and saying, "What part of France is this?" I said, I have no idea. Anyway, we drew near the shore, and everything's quiet. The shore's black. We drawn in, and some men came to take the ropes off from, you know, as they cast them on to moor the ship to the side. There's two men up the front, up the stern end where they were, and I shouted up them. Now, I say this because I was the one that shouted. I said, what place is this, mate? And he said, this is Dover, mate. This is Dover. I was absolutely astounded. I never thought we'd land back in England. And they put the gangplanks down, and we got off this gangplanks. And as we went down them, a host of troops and Red Cross people and different people came to take care of the wounded and lead people along. They led us along through the dark. It was dusk, and we were laden with all our equipment. Not that we needed any help. We were pretty fit compared to some of them who had lost their clothing through swimming in the sea previously, or had been wounded, and were exhausted. And the Red Cross and people were leading them out off the ship, down the gangplank, and a guardsman took charge of us. I always remember this tall man, and he was in his soft cap that we wore them days, that like a fatigue cap, went into the station, into this big warehouse, and all of a sudden were hit by brilliant lights. The place was a flood of lights. And as we went in there, we received a reception there. You think, well, great heroes. There was hundreds of people there, apparently. And as we walked along, they just said, fold your arms. They stuck a pot of tea in one hand, sandwiches dropped into her arms, chocolate, biscuits, apples, all sorts. And this guardsman said, just follow me. Here we are, laden now with goodies, tea and sandwiches. And he opened the carriage door, and he says, in there, and he put us into a carriage and then just left us. That was it. That was fair enough. And we opened our arms, dropped the goods, and we just sat down eating, with our equipment on. And then we got sorted out, and I said to the men, well, this anti-tank rifle we'll put in the corner of the carriage. It was a small compartment with the usual passage running on the side from one joining one carriage to the other. And we put the anti-tank rifle in the corner. We didn't know where we were going, so we took our equipment off, made ourselves comfortable, and the train pulled away. Then someone came along and says, if you want to write any letters, write them and sling them out the station as you pass, and people will post them for you. Well, I looked through my gear, and I had a little luggage label, which I wrote on, and as we passed through a station, I gave it to a person. The train had stopped. We gave it to a person to write. As a matter of fact, we've got it in the room there now. It's one of Annie's souvenirs, and it was telling her, arrived back in Blighty, safe and sound. We'll inform you more later. And that was the first notification then, because the anxious wives and sweethearts and families were all worrying now at the stage as to what happened to their menfolk. And that was the first indication that Annie had got from her. And the postman that she knew, which I knew eventually when I finished the army, he come down the street waving this little card, and he said, he's all right. Because they were all waiting a postman them days on the step. And that was the first notice they got that I was all right. Well, anyway, off we shot on this train. When we went out to post, we found the anti-tank rifle had gone. So, me being what I was, conscientious, I started looking, what's happened to this anti-tank rifle? No one could tell us. It disappeared. What had in fact happened is some stupid person had dumped it out the rear window. None of our lads. Somebody said, oh, these are useless things. Flung it out the window. But I wanted that. I want that for my battalion. I felt that it was good for snipers, for knocking them out of the church towers, which I mentioned before, and shooting through brick walls. It was an ideal weapon for that. But as far as armour was concerned, no good whatever. And it was a very accurate weapon. But anyway, we lost one tank rifle. We landed into a place, Aldershot actually, and we got off the train. It wasn't at Aldershot station, I think it was Mitchett station, and we marched off to a camp where we all led into a big tented camp, and were put so many to a tent. We were still tired at this stage, although maybe it was exhaustion. Maybe it was the state that we're in through all the fighting. I don't know what it was. And we went in this tent.
Did you feel like a defeated army? I mean, did you realise what had happened by then?
Yes, I did. I started feeling it very badly. I'd suffered an awful lot with bombing and shelling, and I think I was feeling a bit shell-shocked. I'll be truthful on that. It's something I realised later on that I was in that state, and that we were a bit, maybe it was a shock of knowing that we were defeated and all this sort of thing, because I was a conscientious young soldier. And the culmination of all the shelling and the bombing that I'd gone through, then I did feel a bit stupid.
And were you still upset about the incident with the mortars and the
No, I've got over that. I've got over that. I'll be talking more about that later on, so we'll leave that. We got in this tent, and there were some soldiers showed us into a tent, and irrespective of rank, we just got down into it, and went to sleep. And apparently we slept the clock around, because it was a beautiful summer weather. We had no food. We had this food off the train. Everyone was just interested in how rest, finished, that's it. We'll have a good night sleep. We woke up the sound of a band playing outside. Bob Bullman and I were still together in the same tent with all of the DLI men. So we start rousing up, and we left our equipment and rifles in the tent and wandered off to see what was happening. And it was the band, and sure enough, there was a DLI man there who we knew very well, being a member of the corporal's mess with us, a fellow called Noble, who had gone away to Nella Hall to become a bandmaster. Well, apparently these were the students from Nella Hall who'd been sent through to entertain the troops, and they were a marvellous band. And Bob Bulmer went speaking to him. I didn't bother speaking to him because he was playing, and Bob went over and had a chat with him. He knew maybe more than me, and he came away. He says, "Martin, we're all right." He says, "He's give us £2 each." He says, "Let's go and get a drink." So we got the lads together and went and had a drink with him, and we hadn't been gone long, because £2 easy got rid of. Of course, it was beer was only sixpence a pint them days, or just a little bit more. I can't remember its full values. Explained about when I first started drinking. Well, I found great solace in drinking now, because it swept away the memories of all the fighting, all the friends that you'd lost, the wounded, the mangled bodies that you saw. And we were in this, such a depressed state that the beer does you good. It lifts you out somehow. And I can't explain. You always feel better after a drink. Now, this is not just this incident alone. This was my whole experience during the war. If you got a good drink, you seem to release the burden and start living again. We went back towards the tent, and I heard a row coming from the tent, and I hurried over to see what was happening. There was a sergeant or a sergeant major there, and he was a Canadian with two men that come to take our rifles away and the Bren guns. And the men said, "You're not taking them away. They're Sergeant Major McLean's. They belong to the battalion, and we're not losing them. We'll cart them all over, and we're not getting them." So this was the argument that went on with the Canadians. So we went in and said, "What's happening?" This person said, "I think it was a Sergeant Major." He says, "We've been sent to collect your weapons." I said, "You're not getting them." I said, "Just as easy as that. So save the arguments. These belong to the 2nd DLI, and these are going back to DLI." Actually, they hadn't, because these were the weapons that took off these people who were passing. But no, they belonged to the DLI, and I knew they were going to be in short supply, because having seen all the stuff dumped, I knew that it was going to be sad consequences for weapons in England when we arrived there. I don't know who gave the order to throw rifles away and destroy them. Maybe it was the incident whereby the people had to go out to sea to get on ships. They couldn't carry equipment and rifles. A short while afterwards, an officer came, a major, I think, was of the Canadian Army, and he came to see. He says, "Sergeant Major," he says, "I've been sent to see you, look." He says, "We don't want these weapons for our battalion." He says, "These weapons have got to go down to Dover straight away in case the Germans follow up with an attack." He says, "Because you must realise the Army is now very badly equipped in weapons, and you seem to be the only men that's come across here with all your weapons, and we must take them off you. And that's where they're going, down for the defence in case the Germans follow up." So we handed over our weapons then, and all the ammunition that we had with them. That was it. We lost them, but they were going to a good purpose. There was no qualms then. If they had explained that in the first instance, there would have been no argument about us losing the weapons. Off they went, willingly. Felt like saying, "Well, we'll go down with them." But I could cater for myself, but not for the other men. We eventually got onto put on another train after a day or two, and no one tells you anything once again. And we shoved off, and we landed up dirty and well, not dirty, ragged, dishevelled. And we landed up in Huddersfield Station in Yorkshire. And when we got out the train, we were supposed to be the last remnants of the BEF coming home. And that I had also with me the Royal Burkes and the Royal Welsh, the people who, you know, I spoke about. They made up contact with me again, and there they were. And there was the mayor of Huddersfield there with all his regalia and a huge staff of his, maybe his councillors or what it was. They welcomed me in, and me being the sort of spokesman, and thanked the lads for what they'd done and gone through. Now, he says, now it's our turn to pay a little compliment to you people. He says, we'll take you, you can have a good bath, and then he says, we'll lay on reception for you. So they took us into swimming baths, and everybody was stark naked, the men. The women had gone by then, of course. We didn't care, into the water, had a good swim, and had been in the showers before and a good wash down. And we did feel clean after this, because we hadn't had a good wash, you know, for days, well, weeks, a month or more. So we had a wash down in the showers and then the swim, got out, and I had a lavish party laid on for us in a room near the swimming baths. The mayor done a bit more talking, and then we all conveyed later on off in private cars to our billets. And I was put in a large private house with some rather well-to-do people. Me and Bob Bulmer once again together.
So you reached Huddersfield in June then?
Yes, it was June, yes. And Bob and I were together and they treated us very well. It turned out this man, who was the man of the house, he was a private in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers in the First World War. And he knew what it was all about, all the war, you know. And he took us to meet his friends in the club. And the whole idea really now was everybody wanted first-hand stories of the Dunkirk episode. And we were just the men to give them it, weren't we? So we went to this club and we told the stories as people were asking us, and I learned that I was becoming quite descriptive of telling stories, and so I was telling the true stories of what we'd seen and what had gone on, and the devastation about the German tanks against flesh, against rifles which are no good at all, which the British Army, the generals and things should have been more prepared for. And we got a good audience, and of course we got plied with plenty of beer, didn't we?
Did you tell them about the things that had gone wrong at the lower level, the, you know, the officers and NCOs who hadn't done the job properly?
No. That was something not for civilians, that was just for me. And as a matter of fact, I kept it quiet all of the time till I now speak to you. I've mentioned two or three times recently, because it's 40 years since and you can speak openly. But these things were not intended for civilian ears. These were army matters which were kept between Bob and I to ourselves. Bob Bulmer talk about, and I discussed these things. And that was it. By the way, Bob Bulmer, I had to write his obituary and send it off to the Durham Light Infantry headquarters yesterday. And I wrote him a good report, as brief as possible. And so this was, when we were in Hull, it became that when we went out...
Huddersfield,
we were grabbed by people. And once I received a message from Bob Bulmer, and I received a message, the quartermaster wants to see you. Well, this is the quartermaster we met at Dunkirk, who Bob Bulmer picked up when he had rubber boots on, and the brigade major had a riding boots on with a heel missing. I've told the story on that. And we went down to the station hotel, which was by the railway, obviously, and there was Ossie Pearson, the quartermaster, ensconced with the crowd of people he'd met up with, and he took us in, and drinks were brought in for us. I thought Ossie Pearson had got them, but the fly old man, he wasn't. He was an old man, by the way. It was the people who were in the hotel that would send the drinks in, and they sat back, now we'll get the stories about Dunkirk, sort of style. And then Captain Pearson asked me to tell the people the stories of Dunkirk, so I got on telling them, and we had a good story. But Ossie Pearson at the finish, he says to me, he says, Sergeant McLean, he says, you've done me a wonderful good turn and picked me up at the beaches of Dunkirk. He says, we would have been prisoners of war if it hadn't been for that. But I never mentioned to him, which I should have done, which I felt like saying, I knew tried to take my second command away from us when you ordered Bobby Bulmer onto the ship with you. I said, but I kept, that was past tense now. And you can't say too much to regular soldiers because they have you on a charge, right, left and centre. A charge is a 252, where it's for discipline reasons you're taking them before the CO, obviously. And he said, if ever I can ever do you a good turn in my army service, he says, just you ask and I shall do it for you. Well, later on, it had many years afterwards, it had funny repercussions, this. Bob and I got drunk on this occasion, and somebody took Bob home to the same place I was in, but I wanted to walk. I didn't want to ride in a car. I wanted to be alone with my own memories. And so I set off to this house. And when I got there, Berry Brow, I think it was, miles away, and I got there, the house was in darkness, but the front door was open. I let myself in, and I couldn't find my way around. First of all, obviously, I wanted to find the toilet. Couldn't find the toilet, and I got in the wrong room without intention. I realised it wasn't our room, and I came out. And so I went out the front door, and there were some fields opposite, and I went and lay down in the fields and went to sleep there till the next morning. You could do this because we were used with it. It was a cold, it wasn't a cold night, but it was pretty uncomfortable after sleeping in beds and things. And when the owner of the house got no, I'd slept in the field, he ranted and raved because he says all you had to do was shout and we'd been there. And, well, we got shifted into a big warehouse shortly after this.
The battalion was concentrating in the Huddersfield area. Was meeting the quartermaster, Pearson, that was the first you knew of that, was it?
Yes. We were moved then to a big old empty warehouse, an old mill in Huddersfield, where the whole battalion was congregated, what was left of them. And it was horrible to see, you know when you look around for your mates and they've gone, and you hear the stories that they've been killed, or they've been wounded, or they've been taken prisoner of war. There was only a handful of the company, the fighting men, left. There was a lot of the drivers and a lot of the quartermaster staff and people who had battalion headquarters. They were all right. But the fighting men of the battalion were just decimated, gone. Well, this shocked me in your sense. I don't think I'd speak to anybody for days on this, because there was eight of us that used to knock around together. And there was only one left of the eight of us, WOs and sergeants. And you couldn't get over it. The feelings of loss, tremendous loss, was that. Anyway, time came, we got in there and decided to send us on a week's home leave. And everybody got their passes and off we went. And this was a joyous occasion to get back to the family. The family were all there to meet us. They greet us and take us out for a drink. And he was delighted to see us. The Ben, now walking. Or was she walking? No, the baby. She wouldn't be walking. All delighted to see us. And they had a party for us. We had a great week's holiday. And then I had to go back to the battalion again and start reforming. Because we couldn't afford too much time away. Because invasion was imminent. And I should imagine that was the keynote when they decided on just a few days leave instead of a long leave. And everybody went back. And then we start re-equipping and getting organised and receiving reinforcements by the hundreds to the battalion. And then the battalion, having received its entitlement of men and still re-equipped with arms, were sent up to take up defensive position in Yorkshire, Bridlington area.
Now these, you were getting more reinforcements than there were original members of the battalion, I would presume. In other words, the whole character of the battalion would be changing. Well, were these reinforcements mainly from the Durhams? Were they mainly Durhams?
They were Durhams, but they were national servicemen called up, and reservists who hadn't been roped in the first instance were getting officers from the depot, officers being roped in from all over the shop, DLI officers and others, and the same with WOs and sergeants who were making the battalion up to strength from raking up all over the country for taking people from training establishments and bring them to join us for to make up the battalion strength. After all, we were the 2nd Division, which was a regular division, and it was expected that we'd be involved with war very quickly again.
And how did these new men fit in?
Well, the men were reluctant at first. They knew they had to go, but they were sulky about it. They were in cushy numbers, a lot of them. The young National Servicemen, they were from depots and places. They were all right. But a lot of the senior NCOs were a bit grumpy about it. I make no bones on that. They didn't like the idea of being posted to a service battalion from their, some of them from their cushy numbers at the depot, which they used to work at the depot, no doubt, but they were away from all the fighting and any involvement in fighting. Because although they are regular soldiers, I cannot say a lot of them were 100% keen to fight.